Welcome to Big Shakti's Light on Yoga and Meditation podcast. My name is Dr. Swami Shankardev. I'm a yoga acharya, medical doctor, psychotherapist, and Vedic astrologer. And I'm a co-creator of Big Shakti along with my partner, Jane Stevenson. This podcast is dedicated to providing you with authentic, accurate knowledge and access to a range of powerful techniques from different wisdom traditions to achieve health, enlightenment, and prosperity. We're also very interested in how to use yoga and meditation to increase both lifespan and health span, to reduce chronic illness, to improve physical and mental resilience, and to accelerate your spiritual evolution. This podcast episode is from an interview with my good friend Ron Ehrlich in 2019 for his podcast, Unstress. For many years, Ron was my holistic dentist. However, he has recently found a new life purpose and has retired to focus on health education. You can find out more about Ron and the wonderful work he's doing at his website, Unstress Online. In this episode, we discuss the vital importance of self-awareness and self-knowledge and how that is the key to finding life purpose. Ron asked me to talk about the admonitions of the great philosophers over the last millennia to know ourselves and to address the question of who we really are. Ron and I both agree that it's never been more important to ask the questions, who am I? Because of the growth of technology and AI, and the fact that if we don't ask ourselves this question, technology may know us better than we will know ourselves, and this is a dangerous thing. Topics in this podcast include the importance of self-awareness and knowing who we are and finding purpose, the three types of purpose, common purpose, life purpose, and ultimate purpose, what is the self, and what is the difference between the authentic self and the ego self, how the ego and all our different selves form, how to manage negative ego patterns, how the ego and shadow form, midlife crisis, chakras, and different types of meditation practice for health and well-being.
My guest today is my good friend, Dr. Shankardev Saraswati. He is a Western medical doctor, a yoga authority, therapist and teacher with over 40 years of experience. And he is also a psychotherapist, an author, and runs many workshops, both live and online. His work integrates Western mind-body medicine and psychotherapy with Eastern methods of mind-body development and awakening consciousness, which makes him a great person to help us explore today's topic. I hope you enjoy this conversation I had with Dr. Shankardev Saraswati. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Ron. Always great to see you.
You know, you've got so many great programs going, and one of them was finding life's purpose, and I wanted to get to that. But sure. Before we did, you know, just before we started this, I was mentioning to you that arguably over history, people have always said it's really important to know yourself, whether it was Aristotle or Plato or Buddha or Christ or whoever. Philosophers over the last thousands of years have always said it's really important to know yourself. And I was saying that arguably it's never now been more important than ever before, because technology, actually we're going to get to the point, and this is an argument from that great philosopher, author, Yuval Noah Harari, you know, technology will know us better than we will ourselves. Because like yesterday I got a reminder about Facebook, something happened in 2012. Mm-hmm. So it reminded me of what I did. If I went through technology, it would know exactly what I've bought, where I've been, how I've traveled, where I've gone, what I liked, what I didn't like. So we're coming to a point in history where actually technology may know us better than we know ourselves. So now it's really important to know ourselves. How do we go about doing that? What do you think? Big question.
Big question. The essential question. I would say the main thing that has to be sorted out before we even talk about that is, which self are you talking about?
Okay.
So there are several selves.
Yeah.
So when the philosophers talk about a self, that word's an umbrella term for a whole lot of different bits of us. And you can say that we have a conditioned self, a created, you know, an artificially constructed social self, which has many parts, multiple bits. So there's a professional self. When you're a different person when you're at work, you're a different person with your family. Different bits of your ego structure come out, and that's an egoic self.
Mm.
And the self that philosophers point to is called an authentic self, or an essential self, or a true self, or the real, you know, the real me. Who am I really? And so that, so the whole quest for self-awareness, self-knowledge, is a kind of peeling the onion of who we are back to this core consciousness, which the philosophers have always said is the true self. So the true self is a consciousness, and the egoic self is a concept that we live out. It's an idea in our head that we've been, I think I am Shankardev, I think I'm a doctor, and so on. But that, you know, I'm a doctor for only, or a yoga teacher, or a yoga therapist and psychotherapist, all those identities that I've got,
mm-hmm.
they're only valid while I'm doing those things. But when I'm down at the beach, I'm not a psychotherapist.
Mm.
Or unless someone comes up and says, you know, hey doc, what's going on?
Yeah, what do you think?
What do you think?
What's the meaning of life?
And I can do that.
Yeah.
But then I can transition into that bit of me.
Mm-hmm.
So when we started chatting, you said, you know, we want to talk about meditation as well. And is that part of the whole quest for self-knowledge? And it is the essential tool. It is both the tool and the state of being in which one realizes who we are. That is a long way from where most people's awareness is. And that opens a huge philosophical, psychological, existential, and scientific discussion about all these things, about this sort of, so what I would say is a journey that we take from an egoic state that's created from our child from birth up to a certain age, and then a point comes where we wake up and we think, you know, is this all I am? Mm. Is there more to me? Because I feel, you know, it's a bit repetitious. I'm kind of doing the same thing. You know, I use the same toothbrush every morning, and then the same family, and the same route to work, the same work, and work's the same, you know, more or less. I've got a bit of variety here and there, but, and life's going on, and I'm just sort of being pulled by society and by demands of the world to respond. But there's a different part of me that's calling. The part of something inside me is calling. What is that call? As soon as you hear the call, then you start to have to turn your attention away from all the triggers, all the stimulus that's pulling you into the world, like social media and family and responsibilities and finances and so on, and you've got to take some time and look within. And it's only that enables you to know yourself, to give yourself the attention and the time you deserve.
We were talking about the subconscious, you know, so much of our, what goes on in our lives is actually subconsciously happening.
Yeah.
And I know last year we talked about psychology of an approach,
mm-hmm.
But we also, I talked to Bruce Lipton, and Bruce, of course, is very big on, as a lot of people are, says, show me the person at seven and I'll show you the adult.
Mm.
And those first 7 years, I mean, are really important.
Yeah.
Would you?
Sure. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So the ego forms between the age of about 0 to 5.
Right.
That's, so you come in as a kind of a, you bring your genetics, and philosophically some traditions would say you bring a past life shadow.
Mm.
You bring the shadow of the past life into this life. So there's something you carry. If there is this concept of a soul or a self that reincarnates, then you bring some karmic residue that you've got to, you're here for a purpose. So part of what we're talking about is, what is the purpose of it all, you know?
Mm.
So you have a purpose. You're born with this purpose. You're born with some kind of, you know, you're either going to be born into wealth, or you're going to be born into poverty, or you're going to be born with certain intellectual or, you know, financial or emotional strengths or weaknesses and so on. And you're going to have to live with that, those limitations. So you're born with a kind of a, you're not a blank slate in the majority of philosophical and scientific approaches. And then you live in a soup of a family. You sort of boil in the soup of your family, and you absorb all of those nutritional, you know, elements that cultivate strengths. But mm-hmm. there's also maybe a few preservatives in there and a few toxins, so that you absorb those into your system as well. And over that time, you are conditioned, and you're conditioned to form what the Jungians would call an ego and a shadow. So your parents will work with carrot and stick to try and get you to conform to their ideas of how the world, you know, how you should be in the world. So, you know, if I poo on the floor, I get a frown.
Mm-hmm.
If I decide I have to make a decision now because I can see my mother's frowning at me, I have to make a decision. Which is better, the poo, you know, enjoy mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. warm, very interesting texture and, you know, it's very useful for walls and stuff, or, you know, do I
try We're talking about the first 5 years of life here that we are.
Yeah. We're not actually. I'll explain why. Okay. This metaphor goes on.
Okay.
Or we go for the smile.
Yeah.
And, you know, personally, I chose the smile. I've stopped pooing on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people choose the poo and continue to shit on themselves throughout their life and the shit on the world.
Yeah.
And they don't look to try and support the world being, you know, happy and so on. So that's so in therapy, we're dealing with people who've made a decision early in life not to look after their own stuff, their own shit.
So those first, this is what intrigues me, and whether it's 5, 7 years, whatever, those early years, really important. I can't remember the first 1, 2, or 3 years. Is that important? I mean, you know, if we're wanting to learn about the influence that these years had on us, and going back to the metaphor of the poo and the smile of the mother or the anger of the mother to teach us a lesson, presumably the reaction of that informed how we viewed the world in future.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's really important for us to understand what was going on in that time. How do we do that?
Well, we see the past in the present. You see what's happening. You see whatever behaviors you're engaged in the present moment are often a reflection of what you learnt back then. So you can't really know fully pre-egoic structure, you know, what's going on. But just want to complete the
metaphor.
But just what happens, how the ego forms. So the ego forms, and everything that's not doesn't feel right for you is pushed into the shadow. So, for example, and that's culture. That's both biological and cultural. So we have to, you know, learn. You know, there are certain boundaries around which we can't go. The society will penalize us if we do things. And you can see in the news all the time people who are doing terrible things to other people, and that is often the shadow. That's the society's shadow. You're not allowed to rob banks. You're not allowed to kill people. You're not allowed to drive drunk. You're not allowed to. You know, if you're in a bank, you can't take people's money if they're dead. Pedophiles, you know, the pedophilia, the child abuse, all that stuff. That's all the shadow. All these things that are not, that don't function, that don't enable us to live as human beings in a society where we support each other's growth and development. So the development of an ego is a contraction of the original state that we're born into. We're born into a kind of an oceanic state of being in which we're connected to the whole universe. There's no ego. We're just this sort of squishy bundle of matter forming, growing and forming. So ego is a biological as well as a psychological process. We're born into this condition, into a limited form that's genetically differentiated and limited by our parents' genes and so on. And then we start to contract, and we form a contracted consciousness, a small conscious mind, and that's when we start to get reflection. That's when we start to be able to say, this is a me, and that's something different. And then I've got to work out what those things are. So I go around, you know, exploring, putting my fingers into different holes in the wall. There's electric holes, and that doesn't work. Or, you know, hot water. Oh, okay, that's interesting, and so on. And the good things. And so you start to discover the world. So you start to form this kind of object relationship with things. You start to work out who you are and what other things are. So that's the formation of an egoic self. And just to finish this off, So your ego develops over the first half of your life. So you start to, you know, who am I? What's my identity? And so you go through school and you study and you take on a profession and then you form a family. I mean, it's a stereotype, it's a general principle for human life, the arc of development. And then at a certain point, you've done most everything. Hopefully you're making money, you know, you're supporting yourself, supporting a family, and you've got some freedoms. And then at around about the age of 40, and this is a very Jungian concept, where everyone needs a bit of a crisis. And the crisis is this sort of midlife crisis. Who am I? What's my life all about? Is this all there is? And that often comes in the form of something erupting out of the unconscious that makes us act in a way that doesn't work for us or others. And we suffer those repercussions. And the classic is, you know, the middle-aged man who runs off with his secretary and she's 20 and buys a sports car and leaves his family. And then usually that doesn't work out, really, because what's coming up is a residue from the unconscious that's not understood or integrated into who we are. And so we go through this crisis and then we start to go on a journey to discover ourselves. And that self-knowledge that you started off talking about is something that's hard won. That takes a lifetime at least to get to. And each one of us that, you know, starts on that journey realizes, you know, how hard it is. It gets harder and harder as you go on in some ways, but it's very, very rewarding. Enlightenment is a gradual process of waking up to who we are. And self-realization is a term used in certain philosophical traditions as to who you really are. This is the final evolutionary step in self-knowledge. You get to a point and then you've moved from animal through the human condition and you get to some kind of superhuman state or suprahuman state. And then the next stage of evolution takes you into a different. So there's this. So humanity is a stage in the evolution of consciousness.
Mm. In Ayurvedic medicine or philosophy, there are chakras, which are 7-year cycle. Can you give us a little bit about chakras 101? Because this is about development, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. Yeah. Chakras are my favorite topic, of course.
What a coincidence.
Isn't that interesting? Just to clarify, Ron, Ayurveda is traditional Indian medicine.
Okay.
It does not deal with the chakras.
Oh, okay.
Just because we need clarification.
Oh, that's a good one.
Is it going?
That's an important one.
It's an important one.
Okay.
Chakras come out of the system. So, you know, these are big topics. Indian
that's
philosophy.
Okay. We've got as much time as you want.
Okay, great. So Indian philosophy has certain branches, and those branches deal with things like medicine, architecture, warfare, politics, spirituality, and so on. And Ayurveda is purely a medical system.
Okay.
And, of course, it has a language that the fundamental concepts of Ayurveda are universal and are shared amongst a lot of philosophies. So certain things. So, for example, the elemental forms, earth, water, fire, air, and space, which make up the three fundamental Ayurvedic humors or doshas, the things that form the human body and mind, vata, pitta, and kapha. Vata is made of space and air and forms the nervous system and so on, and much more. Pitta is fire and water, and kapha is water and earth. So these elemental forms, these are the building blocks of a complete system of medicine. And those building blocks are also used in other philosophies which are designed to take people on a journey towards self-realization. Chakras are part of what's called the Yoga Tantra system. They come out of that system. And that is a system that's mainly practices and based on a theoretical basis, but mainly practices designed to awaken an experience of more of us. How do we get to more of us? And the human body is divided in these systems into three parts: the physical body, a subtle body, and a causal body.
So say it again: physical,
subtle, physical, The subtle, let's think of that as the psychological,
yeah,
and the causal or the spiritual. So okay. Body, mind, and spirit.
Yeah.
But they have a very sophisticated way of categorizing these concepts of body, mind, and spirit into a structured, ritualized approach to, you know, to guide you on a journey inward so that you have a safe, stable ground on which to dive into the unconscious and explore the chaos of the psyche and the spirit, you know, these parts of us that are often shut off mm-hmm. from us, and to come back into our egoic identity and maintain our awareness. So you can say in this concept that the ego lives mainly in the outer world. It's sensorially stimulated. The ego is nourished by sensorial stimulation mm-hmm. and thinking. And then there's this other part of us, the unconscious, the psyche and the spirit, that people know about, talk about, write about. But to actually experience the power of that, that's a quantum leap of power of who we are. So the chakras as a spiritual path are based on the concept that within every human being, there's a potential in us. Cosmic power is potential in us.
Yeah, okay.
And that's what drives and animates this, you know, keeps us alive.
Mm-hmm.
Look, you have to think that being alive is an amazing thing. Having a body is an amazing thing.
Yeah.
The more we study it, the more we understand, you know, the mind and so on, we go, holy shit, this is...
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've been in the healthcare game for over 40 years and I think, but each.
Yeah.
And I think we've often reflected on the more we learn, the more we realize we don't know, which makes it really interesting.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
So, but in this, but you know, and then there's so much more.
Yeah, yeah.
There's just so much. So this philosophy... says that there's this huge power in us, and it's given different terms, but it's a kind of a force. You can say it's a drop of God in everyone if you think in those terms, or it's a drop of spirit. And that you can imagine that if you think of those as a metaphor, it's something that is the essence of what creates us. You know, so you know the sperm and the ovum meet when we're you know being conceived. I've been conceived, which is pretty interesting thought in itself.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't like to think about that moment of conception too much. My parents.
But yeah, no, you know, we never really have an image of it, do we? We should hold it as being so sacred.
Not going there.
No, let's not go there. Let's not go anyway, there. But let's so, move on from but, that
but,
moment.
But the power of that, so that, and then somehow this whole organism grows and goes through its life arc from, you know, that couple of cells into an egoic structure, lives, you know, becomes a child, you know, an adolescent, an adult, and then gets old and withers and things drop off, and then finally we leave. There's something animating that. And so all philosophy about knowing oneself is about saying, well, who am I? Where did I come from? And where am I going? So we take it back to the original premise. And so I was born and I'm going to die. And all philosophy about self-knowledge is really predicated around death and change, because that's the, you know, if everything stayed pretty stable and we weren't going to die, we wouldn't bother.
Kind of, you got all eternity to sort this one out. We'll get there eventually.
That's right. You just keep moving forward. It's that predicates and kind of contextualizes the philosophical search of self-knowledge. So the journey towards self-knowledge and who am I is saying, well, where do I come from, and what is it in me? You know, I mean, I don't want to just understand it in my head. That's a problem. If you only try to understand things in your head, it doesn't satisfy. It doesn't take you on the journey. It's like you read about the journey. You read about the orange, but you don't taste the orange. You don't taste the life. So you've got to dive into the journey. And for most people, reading and getting the knowledge and understanding is the first step. But you've got to dive in. So the chakra system is one of the great systems of Indian philosophy that's preserved and available in the world today. One of the great things about India is that its tradition was preserved and is still intact to some degree. I mean, not everything. We've lost a lot. But
yeah.
And the chakra system is one way that we can use. And it exists, the chakras exist in the subtle body. When we meditate, when the only way to get into the chakras is to meditate, is to turn your attention inward and to begin to perceive and cognize these things in your spinal cord, because they're in the spine, and to feel them. And then they take you into a state of being that opens a doorway into the psyche. So the chakras are a portal into mm-hmm. the psyche. And then true self-knowledge starts to arise.
Okay. Let's go back to some basics here, because yep. you've mentioned chakras, and let's give me chakras 101.
Okay. So chakras are psychic energy centers in the spinal cord. There are six main chakras that regulate the body, mind, and psyche.
Mm-hmm.
And they are, one is in the pelvic floor, which is ruled by the earth element, and it governs the excretion of, you know, the excretion of products from the body. And it's part of the sexual system, or the survival instinct. It's the fundamental basis of human life, in a mm-hmm. sense. Above that is a chakra in the sacrum, the sexual chakra, which governs the whole urogenital system, and it governs the pleasure principle. So sexuality. So the two chakras in the base, earth and water, the pelvic floor and the sacrum, govern sexuality, both as an instinctual need to preserve the species. I mean, we're driven by this, by sexuality, you know, and the need for family and so on, and to preserve life, but also the pleasure that comes from it. And then in the navel, behind the navel and the spine, there's another chakra which governs digestion. It's governed by the fire element. So digestive fire is the principle that operates. It's a transformative principle. It transforms things from one state to another, and it gives health and vitality. And so just to say, you know, if any of these chakras are in a deficient state, then they don't function well. And if they're in an optimal state, then you can digest anything, for example. Mm. Your digestion is potent. And if you've got digestive problems.
Metaphorically as well as literally.
Literally.
And metaphorically.
You can't digest life.
No.
You can't digest life. You can't digest food. You can't digest emotions. You don't have the power. You don't have vitality. You're fatigued. You're down. So the chakras are a good metaphor for this. Then behind the heart in the spine is the heart chakra, which governs feeling and compassion and empathy. And it's the first human chakra. The chakras below that are much more primal energetic principles. You know, they're fundamental animal drives to survival. Procreation, food, pleasure principle, and so on. And then once you get to the heart, you get to this connected, empathic, relational need and drive. And then behind the throat is the chakra of communication, which I'm using right now
mm-hmm.
and you're using because it governs both speech and hearing. And so right now my chakra is functioning. And I am transmitting sound waves through the ether into your ears, and they're penetrating into your brain, and you're nodding. So I know you're present, and I know you're hearing this, yep. and you're translating my sound vibrations into meaning. So that chakra, you know, communication, very powerful.
Mm.
Then the eyebrow center, the sixth of the chakras, is the chakra that governs all brain, mind function for thinking, intuition, and it has higher function. They all have higher functions as well. So for example, the throat chakra would take all my thoughts. I'm not thinking now. I'm just in free flow. This is just coming out. I don't know where it's coming from. Just saying stuff. It's stored in the unconscious.
It's a beautiful and it's coming thing.
Through. Well, good. It's great. Isn't it wonderful?
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And so the thinking chakra is sending information out through my throat.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also putting my heart into it. So I'm trying to...
Mm-hmm.
feel what I'm saying and make it happen. So the chakras are these kind of fundamental things in the spine that rest in an unconscious state for most of us, and we want to make that more available. We want to feel the spinal cord and its role, not just as a physical neurological structure that's controlling each and every single part of our sensation, movement, and internal organ functioning, heart, lungs, whatever. But we want to feel the spine as the basis of consciousness, because it's all that electric energy there is keeping this brain alive and holding and coherent sense of reality. And that reality will change depending on how much power you have in your spine. And so the energy, that coiled potential energy, lives in your pelvic floor. They say there's a goddess there. And if she is awakened and rises up through the spine, all the chakras, all your spine is super energized. And your brain, which usually only uses, say, 10 or 20% of its capacity, moves towards 100%. And that is a concept that is incredible. So we're not just using drugs and nutritionals and so on to do it. We're actually trying through this process, these ancient techniques, yogic techniques. This is yoga, not just postures. This is the deep yoga, to awaken this energy and to power and to connect all the various neurological connections in the brain so that things are connected up internally. And that concept of connection is the true meaning of the word yoga. Yoga means connection, and connection in each and every sense, no matter where it is, in you or in the world, or, you know, whatever.
Mm. You mentioned meditation is also about connection.
Yep.
And you mentioned meditation was a way for us to engage with, you know, tap into these chakras.
Yep.
Tell us a bit about that. Well, one of my questions was going to be, why is meditation so important? And I think you're kind of heading in this direction right now.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Tell us, why is meditation so important?
Okay, so again, what does the word meditation mean? It is an umbrella term for a number of different processes by which one turns one's attention to contemplative acts. The word meditation and the word yoga are synonyms. Yoga means connection, and meditation means connection. In simplest terms, there's a meditator or a meditator and an object of meditation and an act of meditation that unites the subject, the meditator, with the object of meditation. Whatever that object is, there's only one subject. And in the room right now, in my opinion, even though I'm aware that you have a subject in you, I'm the subject, you're the object.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But in deeper meditation, if we connect and we're unified, you and I are one, and the subject merges, there's a merging. Anyway, so meditation basically is this process of where I sit and I place my awareness onto something. It could be myself, could be a flower, could be the breath, could be a sunset. It could be a concept, and I aim to become at one with that so that I really get what's going on. What is that? What is that flower? How do I experience the flower fully? How do I really bring it into me so that I get to know each and every part of that flower in my being? Or how do I experience the beauty of a sunset and allow myself to have that wonderful feeling of beauty and awe at nature and the sun? This giver of light, this massive ball of plasma that's keeping us going, you know, for the time being. So meditation is both the state of connection. So true meditation is a connected state.
With what you are focusing on.
Yeah, with whatever it is.
Without distraction.
Well, it can be actually.
Because distraction's often the biggest enemy of meditation.
In the beginning. But later on, you can be both connected and distracted at the same time. You can be connected to distraction.
What a liberating thought.
Yeah.
I may have already reached that point.
I think a lot of us. But the thing is, you've got to be conscious. You've got to have an expanded awareness that enables you to feel multiple things simultaneously. And that's something that's not easily achieved, because the mind, that means the mastery of the mind. So in the beginning, meditation and relaxation are synonyms. Most people use meditation as a way of relaxing, of calming the nervous system and bringing themselves back into balance, because most of us are in sympathetic overdrive. We're stressed. And I just got to say, I read a great book called Unstressed recently.
Life Less Stressed. You listen to Unstressed.
I listen to Unstressed. There it is.
This is Unstressed. We just pause for a commercial right now.
And a great book, Life Less Stressed. So most of us are stressed, and stress is the killer. It is the number one killer. That's what most people are coming to meditation for. They're worried. They're caught up in the day-to-day grind. They've got problems, debts, financial, relational, or internal. They've got some issue. They're just worried about life or existential issues or whatever it is. And so they come to some sort of meditative process. Could be through music, could be through, can be through movement, can be through doing yoga postures, which can be a meditation that enables you to, you know, calm your nervous system and relax and come back into your body. And you do that in a very meditative way. So there's a meditative way. That's how most people start off. And then to achieve that state of relaxation meditation, this initial state, you need meditation techniques. So just to complete that, meditation is both a technique, endless types of techniques or ways of connecting, and a state of connection. And the state of connection is what most people are after. And that's what's fulfilling, life-affirming, rebalancing, allows you to have a deep intuitive sense that there's more to you and, you know, you feel more connected to that self. And then you're more connected to your purpose. Then you start to feel and understand your purpose. Your purpose isn't just coming from outside of yourself. You think, you're not thinking, oh, I should have that purpose, or that sounds like a great purpose, I'd love to have that purpose. You're connected to your purpose, and it may not be the purpose that you want. That is the battle between the ego and the self. My ego wants this. I'd love to have that purpose. But myself, my deeper unconscious, the bigger part of me says, you're not here for that. And every time you try to go for that purpose that you've artificially, you know, you've kind of thought through, it doesn't work. And it doesn't give you satisfaction. You keep butting your head up against it, and it's just not doing it for you. And then finally, you surrender, and suddenly you find that deeper purpose, and you think, yeah, this is what I'm meant to do.
So these chakras, you know, these six chakras, part of meditation is about focusing in on those?
Yeah.
Or is that just a flow-on effect, a benefit, that through the deeper calming of the mind and the focusing on a particular thing, whatever that may be, it allows for the flow through the chakras to rebalance them? Is that oversimplistic?
No, I think that's perfect. I think it's both.
Well, thanks for joining me today. No, there's still more to discuss.
There is, yeah.
No, but that is how we use meditation in the chakra system.
Yeah. So you can do – so what happens is that because these are natural structures, they're psychic energy centers contained within physical matter or embodied in physical matter, every time we meditate, we turn on our third eye, our eyebrow center. Every time we meditate, that part of us is relaxed and brought back into a degree of balance. And so we can think a bit more clearly. We can, our emotions, you know, our heart probably feels a little calmer, and we get some insight, and then we have to dive back into life and carry that with us back into life. So what I was saying is you've got these initial stages of meditation, which are relaxation, and then you go on to these more advanced levels if you're interested. And chakra meditation would be called an intermediate level of meditation technique, where having learnt to relax and calm the mind to a degree, and your lifestyle's in balance and you've got everything in place, so you've got a bit of time, then you can go in and you can start to focus on these chakras, and that awakens the subconscious mind or the unconscious mind. So you start to move into relationship with your unconscious. Your unconscious starts to become more informative. You start to listen to your deeper self. And that deeper self, as you remove the impurities, or the, they call it impurities, but as you bring things back into a more integrated state, the signals that you're receiving from your unconscious have greater clarity. It's like you've tuned the radio. There's not so much noise, and you're getting these clear signals from the deeper you. And then you no longer need to, you no longer look outside of yourself so much for information and understanding. And you realize that all the great knowledge that's in the world has come from within another human being. And that's all available in you to some degree, depending on your nature, capacity, and so on.
This is great because, you know, I think a lot of people would have meditation on their to-do list. You know, they think, yeah, I'm definitely getting, this year I'm getting into meditation for sure. And they sit and they do whatever form of meditation, whether it's focusing on the breath or a mantra is another thing. Is the sound an important aspect there?
So it's a technique.
Just another technique, mantra.
Well, I wouldn't say just another technique.
Very powerful.
I would say one of the great tools. Now, there are different systems.
Right.
And they're siblings.
And so they have a little rivalry. So some systems say don't do mantras, and some people systems
say. So this is the politics of meditation.
The politics of spiritual.
Wow.
Spiritual stuff.
Okay. I was going to say something else, but you've kind of grabbed my attention there. What's the story there? Some people think the sound, and I would think the sound does add another dimension to the meditation.
It opens up this very – it really takes us down another track. But I just say –
let's not get too distracted.
Well, just to give you a quick – I think what happens is that you have a knowledge. You have knowledge in its purest form, and then that knowledge has to be embodied in a human being. And each one of us has strengths and weaknesses, and we have certain biases. Some people are very intellectual and rational. Some people are very emotional. And so I would say that when people teach all these different types of these systems, they teach it from within their own inherent structure, their own bias, their own prejudice, their own understanding of the world, and that's always limited. So every human being is limited, and all teaching is limited. And probably the most critical thing to come out of this particular question you asked me is that listen to everybody, but look within yourself and find the answer for yourself. Because you're gonna find your own truth. You're probably gonna write a book, and you're probably gonna add to the confusion, and that's all good.
Yeah. But when you've been teaching meditation for many years, and so do you personalize, can you talk to somebody and hear what their story and look at them and think of them as a certain, saying, I think this form of meditation, the use of a mantra, would be powerful for you, but for you it may not be.
Yeah.
Are you able to do that as a teacher? Do you feel you?
I think so.
Yeah. Well, I assume so. But can you give us some insight? How do you make that call?
Well, look, again, so it's like any profession. You learn all the tools of your trade. So some systems, so this also kind of leads back to what you were saying before. Some systems have only one technique. So, for example, TM, Transcendental Meditation, just uses a mantra. That's it.
Mm.
And they do have some other techniques. More
that
advanced.
Has now morphed into they call it Vedic, do they? Or is that a different one again?
There are branches.
Okay.
They're branches of the tree,
Okay.
The Vipassana style of kind of comes out of a certain Buddhist tradition of meditation only uses mindfulness.
Yeah.
And they are anti-mantras as a general. And in some of their branches, some of their schools are – will say, just do mindfulness, just sit quietly, and that's it. And that's a technique, and that's an approach, and that's valid within that school. And so you do have multiple different approaches to meditation. So, look, for example, you can divide meditation into passive and active, where you just sit passive, just sit quietly and observe your mind or observe your thoughts, or open your eyes and just look out into space, which is a Buddhist technique. Or you've got active techniques in which you create a visualization, you use breathing, you're actively trying to change the state of your being. So as a yoga therapist, psychotherapist, dealing with mental illness or with physical illness, I would advise people to use certain techniques that enable change, enable an intervention that moves them from a state of suffering to a state of health and well-being as quickly as possible. And then depending on their nature, so if they're very emotional, then we work with one way. If they're very intellectual, another. If they're very, some people are very active, they don't like to sit still, they can't sit, so we need to find a meditation that suits their personality. And we can just take different tools.
Is this part of assessing? Because what I was going to say that I'm finding rather interesting and exciting actually about this is that meditation, which moves towards unblocking of the chakras and increasing our all those 6 points, which are clearly important in a well-balanced body, yeah, is a really interesting goal to aim for. You know, whereas if meditation is about just sitting still for 20 minutes and being quiet, well, my mind, and I think, well, yeah, okay, no, it's good. I mean, maybe this is just a question of practice, and it is.
Mm.
But if when I get really good at this step, then I can move to the deeper step of exploring my chakras,
yeah,
that kind of piques my interest even more, because I'm right, kind of, maybe I'm just goal orientated or something, but yeah, I kind of think, wow, this actually explains how powerful meditation can be.
Yeah. And it's a very intelligent strategy to think about how do we apply these things in a way that keeps us moving away from illness through to optimal health.
Yeah.
Most people start off with a you know, a short practice. I mean, I have business people come to me, I give them a 10-minute meditation.
I was going to ask about time.
10 minutes, plenty. That's like a minimum for me. Yeah. You can take a breath and relax a little bit.
Yeah.
But to meditate, you need at least 10 minutes. And then what I tell my patients is that if they want to progress on the path that you suggested towards greater well-being, that they add 10-minute increments on, maybe 5 minutes at first and then mm-hmm, 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. And each 10-minute increment gives you a little bit more depth, takes you a bit deeper. And the majority of people will go to 20 minutes or 30 minutes. 20 minutes is like, I think, in a busy world, that's pretty good. Mm-hmm. And they'll get tremendous benefits from that, and that's all they'll need. Another group of people who come to me and say, look, I'm really interested, I want to go further, then we add more increments. And each time you add a little bit more time on, it enables you to set up a ritual in which you open up various parts of yourself. And so you get one bit to feel good, but you can feel there's another bit that's not quite as good.
Mm.
So then you want to work on that bit. And then the level of joy mm-hmm. and bliss in the body is exponentially, it's an exponential curve. It's not linear.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, you get this tremendous well-being.
Mm.
And then you add on a bit more. And so chakra meditations require time. And there's a ritual that you go through. You go through a process. You sit down. You have to become comfortable. You've got to relax. Then you've got to get your mind out of all of the day-to-day stuff. And thinking, and you know, distraction mm-hmm. is, you know, we're thinking.
Mm.
And then you've got to turn your attention inward. And depending on how prepared you are, will depend on how long it takes you to get rid of the debris and to get down and to experience the chakra.
Mm.
That takes time. For the majority of people, it takes years mm-hmm. of training. Because what is the self? What is meditation? What is purpose? And what is the mind? The mind is an enormous power. Within the yoga tantra traditions, the chakra traditions, the mind is seen as an enormous power. You know, what we experience in our daily life is a small fragment of that mind. You know, we think with it and we apply it a little bit, but a lot of the time we don't have the energy to really think. You know, we're tired from, you know, busy lives, sometimes poor diet and stressful environment and pollution, you know, and stuff. Let's come back to purpose for a bit here.
Mm.
What is purpose? Purpose is everything in life has a purpose. Purpose can be divided into three parts. I have a purpose for being here with you. I'm here with a purpose, and my purpose aligns with your purpose. So we have what's called common purpose. That's one form of purpose.
Mm-hmm.
The second is life purpose. My life has a purpose. You know, like some people are born to be musicians, some people are born to, you know, to deal with illness. It can be my purpose is to manage my multiple sclerosis. You know, I've got MS and my purpose is now all to learn all about the body and the mind and how do I manage this disease. It's not what I would have chosen. But it's here, or cancer, mm-hmm. or something. And the third form of purpose is ultimate purpose. And we run a course on this in our, on our website, which about how to find life purpose. But the third form of purpose, which is this kind of self-realization that everybody on the planet, in my opinion, and within the opinion of certain philosophies, is to find out who they are. And that journey is facilitated by chakra meditations. The initial driver is the sense of well-being. But ultimately, even that leaves an emptiness, a spiritual vacuum. And that spiritual vacuum is only filled by connection to self. And that self lies deeply, deeply, deeply buried at the very heart of who we are. And to touch that is to change the totality of your understanding of who you are and what life's all about. And the chakras are an intermediate stage that give you a platform, a structure in the psyche that enables you to improve your health, improve the functioning of your digestion and your heart and your thinking and all of that, so you live a better external life, but also to create this deeper internal connection to self.
I think what we've been talking about today has been fantastic and given me a greater motivation to explore meditation more deeply.
Yeah. Big questions, big challenges, but as we have said, arguably there has never been a more important time to know yourself and to find life's purpose. Like many of you, I'm sure meditation has always been, well, I know it's been on my to-do list and I have drifted in and out of it for many years, but talking with Shankardev again reminds me of why working with a teacher can be so helpful. Offering tips, encouraging you not to be too hard on yourself, the importance of practicing and explaining various techniques and benefits and challenges that you will face as an individual. I really like the concept of chakras. Shankardev is actually writing a book on this very subject. What I love about it is that it views the body as a whole, interconnected, in balance or out of balance, and that what we do should try to restore and maintain good energy flow. Einstein said every atom in the universe, and that includes your body, is both energy and matter, and yet so much of our Western approach seems to be focused on the matter, the symptom, and ignore the energy. Look, we'll have links to Shankardev's website where he runs some fantastic online courses on meditation, yoga therapy, and finding life's purpose, and more. I think his 40 years of experience in this area, while also being a trained medical practitioner with a practice focused in psychotherapy, puts him in a very unique position.
If you would like to know more about what we do at Big Shakti, please go to www.bigshakti.com where you can see all of our products and offerings. And you can sign up for our free newsletter. And when you do sign up, you're entitled to a 15% discount on your first purchase. And subscribers, of course, get generous discounts on all our products from time to time, especially when we release a new course. And we do have courses for everyone, from beginners on the path to yoga teachers and sincere aspirants and psychologists and therapists and health professionals. And many of our courses are downloadable and can be done in your own time. And we also run live online training every year. All of our courses provide you with the opportunity to experience and understand the powers and mysteries of your mind and spirit. Unwind. Take a break from your daily activities and learn how to use different forms of meditation to achieve inner tranquility, happiness, fulfillment, and spiritual awakening. You will learn the keys to a healthy lifestyle, a calm, clear mind, emotional resilience, and spiritual insight.